Have you ever just stopped and thought about that, well, that amazing blueprint, the one tucked inside pretty much every living thing? It's basically the instruction manual for how we all come to be, everything on the planet.
It really is incredible when you think about it.
Yeah. So today, that's what we're diving into. We got these fantastic lectures you shared from Dr. Ty C.M. Hoffman.
Oh, he's excellent. Really breaks things down.
He really does. So clear. Our mission here is to unpack those core ideas from his genetics lectures. We'll trace it from, you know, the very start.
Oh.
The father of genetics.
Mendel.
Right, Mendel. All the way through to some of the more complex stuff we understand now. Should be some surprises, some real aha moments along the way.
Definitely. And Dr. Hoffman really drives home how getting these basics helps you understand so much more about life, you know, from tiny cells right up to whole populations. It all connects.
Okay, so let's jump in, starting with Gregor Mendel, the father of genetics. And Dr. Hoffman points out something pretty wild. His incredibly careful work back in the 1800s was basically ignored, went unappreciated until long after he died. And discovered in the 1900s. Can you imagine?
It's amazing, isn't it? And Dr. Hoffman explains why Mendel was so, well, different for his time. Most biologists then were observational.
Just looking at things?
Right. But Mendel, he used statistics. He did experimental replication, doing things hundreds, if not thousands of different times for his studies. That was unique.
That replication sounds key. Getting enough data.
Absolutely. It let the patterns, the real patterns, emerge clearly. His contemporaries just weren't thinking statistically like that.
And Dr. Hoffman mentions Mendel's choice of subject was also, well, maybe a bit lucky. Pea plants.
It certainly helped. They were, as he says, easy to grow and easy to work with experimentally. Super practical for the kind of detailed work he needed to do.
So how detailed are we talking? Dr. Hoffman describes his method.
Oh, incredibly meticulous. He'd actually cut away the stamens from the flowers so they couldn't self-pollinate.
Ah, okay. Control.
Yeah, total control. Then he'd use a little brush to take pollen from a specific male parent plant and put it onto a specific female parent. He knew exactly which parent mated with what female parent. No guesswork.
Wow. And the patients involved. Dr. Hoffman talks about waiting for the fruit. Then the seeds, planting those, waiting for them to grow.
Exactly. Just to see the traits in the next generation. It was a long game. Real commitment.
Okay, before we get to his results, Dr. Hoffman makes a point about terminology. Characteristic versus trait. They sound similar.
Yeah, people mix them up. But Dr. Hoffman's distinction is important. A characteristic is the general thing, like flower color or eye color, or even something like enzyme speed.
Okay, the category.
Right. And a trait is the specific version, the value for that characteristic. So purple or white are traits for the characteristic flower color. Brown or hazel are traits for eye color. You need that clarity for Mendel's work.
Got it. So characteristic flower color, traits, purple, white. Makes sense. Now, Dr. Hoffman walks us through Mendel's big experiments. Seven major sets, he calls them.
Mm-hmm. And each one focused on just one characteristic. And here's another bit of that luck Dr. Hoffman mentioned.
Yeah.
Each characteristic he studied had only two possible traits, like just purple or white flowers, not a whole spectrum. That simplicity was key.
Okay, so let's take his main example, the pea generation cross.
Right, the parental generation. He took true breeding purple plants and crossed them with true breeding white plants. True breeding, meaning they always produce offspring like themselves.
And the result in that first offspring generation, the F1s, this is where it got weird, right?
Totally counterintuitive. Dr. Hoffman emphasizes this. The F1 generation was 100% purple flowered, no white ones at all.
None.
Zero. And they weren't pale purple either. They were just as purple as the purple parent. Now think about it. For ages, people thought traits blended, like paint, you'd expect maybe a lilac color, right?
Yeah, well, Mick.
But nope, pure purple. That told Mendel something fundamental was happening. Discrete units, not blending.
Okay, so the white trait just vanished.
Seemed like it. But Mendel, being Mendel, kept going. He let those F1 plants self-pollinate or cross them with each other to get the F2 generation.
Yeah.
And the white trait reappeared in the F2. It hadn't vanished. It was just hidden. That's why we call it recessive, Dr. Hoffman explains, from recede to hide.
And the purple, the one that showed up.
That's the dominant trait. It masks the recessive one when both are present.
And this is where the numbers became crucial, wasn't it? Dr. Hoffman highlights that ratio.
Yes. Because Mendel did it so many times, he saw a consistent pattern in the F2 generation. An almost exactly 3.1 ratio of dominant phenotypes, purple, to recessive phenotypes, white. Three purple for everyone white.
Wow. That specific ratio must have been mind-blowing.
It was proof. proof that traits were passed as these discrete units, and it showed the mathematical relationship between them. The large sample size made it statistically solid.
So this kind of experiment, focusing on one characteristic like flower color, what does Dr. Hoffman call that?
That's a monohybrid cross. Mono for one characteristic being tracked, where the parents have different traits for it. And Dr. Hoffman points out, this cross reliably gives you that 100% dominant phenotype in the F1 and the 3.1 phenotypic ratio in the F2. It's a classic Mendelian pattern.
Okay, so Mendel saw the pattern, the ratios.
Mm.
But he didn't know what was actually being passed down, the mechanism inside the plant.
Exactly. He didn't know about DNA or genes. So Dr. Hoffman then takes us down to the molecular level to explain the why behind Mendel's observations.
Right. So what's the basis?
Well, it all comes down to genes. Dr. Hoffman describes them as tiny sections on these really long DNA double helixes called chromosomes.
Okay.
These genes, he says, code indirectly for how to build a protein. And it's those proteins that ultimately give the organism its traits. So one gene generally corresponds to one characteristic.
Like the flower killer characteristic.
Exactly. And the different versions of that gene, like the purple version or the white version, those are called alleles. Alleles correspond to traits.
Okay. Gene for characteristic, alleles for traits.
Yep.
Got it. And they live on the chromosomes.
Yep. Each gene has a specific spot, its address, on a chromosome. Dr. Hoffman calls that its locus, or loci for plural. It's very organized.
Which leads us to another key distinction Dr. Hoffman makes. Phenotype versus genotype.
Crucial difference. Your phenotype, he explains, is the observable trait, what you actually see or measure. White flowered, brown eyes, fast enzyme.
The physical description.
Right. Your genotype is the underlying genetic makeup, a symbolic representation of the actual set of alleles you have. We use letters for this.
Like for the flower color.
Yeah. Typically uppercase for the dominant allele, lowercase for recessive, so P for dominant purple, P for recessive white. Since organisms like peas and us are deployed two copies of each chromosome, you have two alleles for each gene.
So what are the possible combinations?
Dr. Hoffman lays out three possibilities. You can be homozygous dominant, two dominant alleles like PP. That plant is true breeding purple. Or you can be homozygous recessive, two recessive alleles, PP. That's the only way to get the recessive phenotype. So that plant is white flowered.
Makes sense. And the third?
Heterozygous. One dominant and one recessive allele, PP. Now, in classic Mendelian inheritance, Dr. Hoffman stresses that one dominant allele is sufficient to fully give you that trait. So even though it carries the white allele, a PP plant looks purple. Its phenotype is purple.
Okay. PP purple, PP white, PP purple. That explains the F1 generation being all purple. They must have all been PP.
Exactly. When you cross PPXPP, all the offspring have to be PP.
Right. Now, keeping track of all these P's and P's, Dr. Hoffman introduces that handy tool, the Punnett square.
Yeah, developed by an Englishman, Reginald Punnett. Dr. Hoffman clarifies it's more than just a box diagram. It actually represents the biological process of fertilization.
How so?
Well, the letters along the top and side represent the possible alleles in the haploid gametes, the sperm and egg. The boxes inside show the possible diploid combinations when those gametes fuse the potential genotypes of the offspring, the zygotes.
Ah, I see. It maps out the probabilities.
Precisely. So if you do a Punnett square for that F1 cross, PPXPP, you immediately see why you get that F2 result. One box PP, two boxes PP, one box PP, that's the 1.2.1 genotype ratio.
And since both PP and PP look purple,
you get the 3 purple to 1 white phenotype ratio. It makes Mendel's observations perfectly predictable.
Very cool. Okay, what about that test cross Dr. Hoffman mentioned? What's that for?
Ah, the test cross is clever. Let's say you have a purple pea plant. You know its phenotype is purple, but you don't know its genotype. Is it PP or PP?
Right, could be either.
So you do a test cross. You cross your mystery purple plant with a homozygous recessive plant, a white one, which you know is PP.
Okay, why the white one?
Because the white one can only contribute a PEEP allele. So if any white offspring show up in the next generation, your mystery purple parent must have been carrying that hidden PEEP allele. It had to be PP. If all the offspring are purple, the parent was likely PP.
Smart. Using the recessive to reveal the unknown. Okay, that covers one characteristic.
Yeah.
But Dr. Hoffman pushes further. What about tracking two at once? The dihybrid cross.
Yep. Now it gets a bit more complex, but also more revealing. A dihybrid cross means simultaneously paying attention to two different characteristics, like maybe seed color, yellow versus green, and seed texture, round versus wrinkled, in peas.
Okay, two things at once.
So you start with parents true breeding for opposite combinations, say round yellow, RRY, crossed with wrinkled green, RRYY. The F1 generation predictably will all show both dominant traits, they'll all be round yellow, with the genotype RRYY.
Still following the dominance rule. But the F2 is where it gets interesting.
Very interesting. Because now you have to consider how these different pairs of alleles sort themselves out when the F1 plants make gametes. Dr. Hoffman introduces the principle of independent assortment, meaning the way the alleles for seed shape, R and R, separate into gametes is independent of how the alleles for seed color, Y and Y, separate. They don't stick together just because they came from the same parent. This happens because the chromosome pairs line up randomly during meiosis.
So you can get new combinations.
Exactly. You predict you'll get recombinant types combinations not seen in the original P generation, like round green seeds or wrinkled yellow seeds.
And does the math work out again? Is there a ratio?
There absolutely is. Dr. Hoffman highlights the famous 9.3.3.1 phenotypic ratio for a dihybrid cross F2 generation, 9 showing both dominant traits, 3 showing the first dominant and second recessive, 3 showing the first recessive and second dominant, and 1 showing both recessive traits.
It's a 9.3.3.1.
Oh. And the crucial thing, he stresses, is that experimental evidence matches this ratio incredibly well. It's strong proof that alleles for different genes typically assort independently.
It really boils down to probability then, doesn't it? Like Dr. Hoffman's coin flip analogy.
It's exactly like that. Each allele in a parent has a 50-50 chance, a 12 probability, of ending up in any given gamete. To find the probability of getting a specific offspring genotype, you just multiply the probabilities of getting the necessary alleles from each parent. It's all mathematical chance governed by these biological rules.
Okay, so Mendel's work laid this incredible foundation.
Yeah.
But life isn't always that simple, is it? Dr. Hoffman points out those two key assumptions Mendel worked with.
Right. Exactly. Two alleles per gene and one being completely dominant.
What happens when those assumptions aren't true? Dr. Hoffman says, here's where it gets really interesting. This is non-Mendelian genetics.
Exactly. And the first example he gives is incomplete dominance. You still have two alleles, but the dominant one doesn't completely dominate the recessive one.
So what happens?
You get a third phenotype, an intermediate one. His classic example is snapdragon flowers. Red crossed with white doesn't give you red F1s. It gives you pink F1s.
Like blending paint after all.
Sort of. He explains that often the heterozygote, say RR for red-white, makes half as much of the red pigment protein as the R homozygote. That half amount isn't enough for full red, resulting in pink.
So the F1 by F1 cross, right. Pink x pink. What ratio does that give?
Instead of 3.1, you get a 1.2.1 phenotypic ratio. One red, RR, two pink RR, one white R. The genotype and phenotype ratios match here.
Okay, that's one twist. What else did Dr. Hoffman cover?
Multiple alleles. This is where, within a whole population, there are more than two possible alleles for a single gene, even though any individual still only carries two.
An example.
The best one, which he uses, is the human ABO blood group. There aren't just two alleles. There are three main ones, IA, IB, and I.
I see. So more options in the gene pool.
Exactly. And the ABO system also illustrates another non-Mendelian concept Dr. Hoffman discusses, codominance.
Wait, is that different from incomplete dominance?
Yes, definitely different. In codominance, two different alleles are both dominant, and crucially, if you have both, both of the phenotypes will be expressed at the same time, and they'll both fully be expressed.
So not a blend like pink flowers?
No blend. Think type AB blood. An individual with genotype IAIB doesn't have intermediate AB antigens. They fully express both A antigens and B antigens on their red blood cells. Both alleles show up completely.
Ah, okay. And Dr. Hoffman mentioned the clinical side of this, blood transfusion.
Right. It's vital. Your blood type, A, B, AB, or O, based on the allele being recessive, determines which antigens are on your cells and which antibodies are in your plasma. Mixing incompatible types causes a dangerous reaction. That's why type O is the universal red cell donor, no A or B antigens, and type AB is the universal red cell recipient, no anti-A or anti-B antibodies.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Okay, what other complexities did Dr. Hoffman bring up?
He talked about epistasis. This is where genes interact, where the product of one gene will affect the expression of another gene, might be totally separate.
One gene interfering with another.
Kind of, yeah. His example was coat color in rats. There's a B gene. E for black is dominant over B for brown. Simple enough. But there's also a C gene. If the rat has two recessive C alleles, genotype CC, it blocks all pigment production.
So it's albino.
Exactly. A CC rat is albino, regardless of whether it has BBBB or BB alleles. The C gene is epistatic to the B gene. It controls whether the B gene's phenotype can even be seen.
Wow, gene teamwork or interference. Okay, anything else?
Then there's pleiotropy. This is sort of the opposite idea. One gene simultaneously affecting more than one characteristic. One gene, multiple effects.
Like what?
His key example is the gene responsible for sickle cell disease in humans. That single gene difference doesn't just affect red blood cell shape, causing sickle cell anemia. It also affects a person's resistance to malaria.
One gene, two different outcomes. And that leads to the heterozygote advantage idea, right?
Precisely. As Dr. Hoffman explains, if you have two copies of the sickle cell allele, you get severe disease. Two normal copies, no disease, but no malaria protection. But if you're heterozygous, one normal, one sickle allele, you usually don't have the full disease, but you get significant protection against malaria.
So being a carrier is actually beneficial in some environments.
In places where malaria is common, yes. Heterozygotes are more likely to survive and reproduce, which is why the sickle cell allele persists in those populations, even though it causes disease in homozygous individuals. It's a classic example of natural selection balancing risks and benefits.
Amazing. Okay, one more. Seems like you're getting intricate.
Just about. The last one Dr. Hoffman covers is polygenic inheritance. This is kind of the flip side of cleiotropy. Here, one characteristic is being affected by multiple genes.
Many genes, one trait.
Exactly. Think about human skin color. It's not just light or dark, right? There's a whole continuum of shades. Dr. Hoffman explains this is because multiple genes contribute. Each gene might add a little bit of pigment or not, and the final skin color is the sum total effect of all those different genes acting together.
An additive effect. Makes sense for things with lots of variation.
Right, like height, weight, even things like risk for certain diseases. Yeah. Many genes involved.
So, okay, we've gone from Mendel's simple ratios to all these, well, complications and nuances. What's the big takeaway for us? Dr. Hoffman made a point about genes versus environment, didn't he?
Oh, absolutely crucial point. He really emphasizes that your phenotype, what you actually are and look like, has both a genetic component and an environmental component. It's not just nature or nurture, it's nature and nurture.
Genes aren't destiny then?
Not entirely. His go-to example is identical twins, genetically identical humans. If they're raised in vastly different environments, exposed to different diets, stresses, lifestyles, over time, they won't look perfectly identical anymore. Their shared genes are interacting with different environments, leading to different phenotypic outcomes.
That's a powerful illustration. Mm. So how do we study human genetics if we can't do controlled crosses like Mendel did?
Well, Dr. Hoffman mentions the traditional method. Pedigree analysis, basically drawing detailed family trees and tracking how traits appear across generations.
Looking for patterns.
Exactly. For instance, if a child shows a recessive trait, like, say, cystic fibrosis, but the parents don't, you instantly know both parents must be heterozygous carriers. You can deduce genotypes by looking at the family patterns. He does note, though, that this is getting a bit old-fashioned.
Because now we can look directly at the DNA.
Precisely. Which brings us to his final topic. Modern genetic tests, things like amniocentesis or chorionic villus sampling, CVS.
Ways to test a fetus.
Yes, these procedures allow doctors to get a sample of fetal DNA during pregnancy. They can then test for specific genetic disorders, which is especially useful if the parents know they are carriers for a recessive condition. It offers direct insight into the fetus's genotype.
It's incredible how far we've come from Mendel's piece. It really is. From those foundational 3.1 ratios to understanding codominance, epistasis, polygenic traits. Dr. Hoffman's lectures really map out that journey and show just how complex and frankly elegant the whole system of inheritance is.
It truly is. And, you know, as Dr. Hoffman points out, with our growing ability to analyze this genetic blueprint directly, it does make you think.
Yeah.
Given that strong interplay between our genes and our environment, nature and nurture, what does that really mean for how we view individual potential or even our responsibilities as a society? It leaves you with some pretty big questions to chew on, doesn't it?